Welcome to the deep dive. We're so glad you're joining us today because we are tackling a situation that I think almost everyone who's ever worked in a corporate office has faced.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Like, think about this for a second. Have you ever been pushed by a boss to just cut a corner so you could hit some, you know, massive deadline?
Yep, it's a tale as old as time.
Exactly. You know that exact feeling. The clock is ticking, the client is breathing down your neck, the budget is bleeding, and suddenly a manager steps in and says, "Hey, just make it happen. We'll sort out the paperwork later."
Right, right.
It is a classic, universally understood workplace dilemma. But what happens when that corner you are being asked to cut isn't just an annoying internal company policy, but a strict federal law?
Yeah, that is the exact moment when a standard Tuesday afternoon at the office can just quietly transform into a multi-million dollar federal compliance nightmare.
Wow.
And, you know, the wildest part of these situations is that most of the time, the people involved do not even realize they have crossed a legal line until the damage is already done.
And it's irreversible at that point.
Totally irreversible.
Yeah.
And they did it while genuinely trying to do a good job.
Which is exactly why we are unpacking this really fascinating corporate leadership scenario provided by Excellus today. It's titled Grant Access Now, Classify Later.
Such a good title.
It really is. And our mission for this deep dive is to analyze exactly why otherwise highly competent, well-meaning leaders mistakenly treat strict export controls as just another deferrable program bottleneck.
Right.
We want to understand how the overwhelming pressures of authority and looming deadlines can just completely override annual compliance training. Especially in those, you know, high-stakes, fast-moving environments.
Because if we look closely at the source material, I mean, this is not a story about malicious corporate criminals plotting in a boardroom to steal state secrets.
No, not at all.
It's a story about a very common, almost celebrated business practice, the agile management of workflow bottlenecks, but it's colliding violently with immovable federal regulations.
Right.
The tension between the desire to work fast and the legal obligation to work securely is incredibly revealing here.
Okay, let's unpack this. To really understand how this catastrophe unfolds, mm-hmm. we need to look at the specific case study from Excellus. So imagine you are working at a company developing Project Helios.
Okay.
This is their flagship flight control program. The stakes are massive for the business. The final design review, which is the absolute make or break moment where they prove the viability of the program to the customer and secure the next round of funding, is exactly 3 weeks away.
Crunch time.
Total crunch time.
Yeah.
But they have hit a severe bottleneck. Every single control technical file requires an export sign-off before it can be shared with the wider working group.
Right.
And the compliance team. They are running 2 weeks behind on those sign-offs.
Oof.
Yeah. So the engineers are entirely paralyzed, the deadline is slipping, and the pressure is building by the hour.
And, you know, from a purely operational standpoint, that system is practically begging a leader to intervene.
It really is.
You have a fixed deadline, a massive financial imperative, and what looks like a bureaucratic holdup. I mean, this is the exact environment where incredibly risky decisions get disguised as necessary corporate agility.
And intervene he does. Enter Daniel Reyes. He's the vice president of engineering for Project Helios.
Here we go.
Right. Picture the scene. It is 4:51 p.m. on a Tuesday. The frustration is clearly boiled over. Daniel sits at his keyboard and fires off an email to the team lead, the program manager, and the entire working group.
The whole group.
The whole group. His directive is blunt. He writes, "We can't keep waiting 2 weeks for export sign-off on every file. Give the working group access to the full Helios technical library now, and we'll true up the classifications after the review."
Oh, man.
And then he adds the kicker. He literally writes, "I'm accepting the timeline risk. Please proceed."
I'm accepting the timeline risk. Those are famous last words in the compliance world. He is fundamentally misunderstanding the nature of the risk he is looking at.
See, when I read that email in the source material, it immediately made me think of a real-world analogy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, to me, Daniel's move is like a restaurant manager deciding to skip the mandatory city health inspection just to get the front doors open for the massive Friday dinner rush.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. The manager assumes, hey, we could just bring the health inspectors in to clean the kitchen on Saturday, but, you know, you might get the customers fed and make your Friday revenue, but you have already broken the health code. The violation happened the second you served the food.
Exactly.
But as I think about my own analogy, Daniel is the vice president. He is not some rogue mid-level manager trying to look good. Executives accept program risks all the time to hit major milestones.
Sure they do.
They have entire spreadsheets, risk acceptance matrices, and formal processes designed specifically to bypass roadblocks.
Yeah, it's their job.
Right. So why is this specific decision any different from a VP, say, deferring a complex software bug fix until the next patch so the product can launch on time?
What's fascinating here is the fundamental category error that Daniel's making. And it is an error that highly effective, celebrated leaders make all the time.
Because they're used to being in charge.
Exactly. They overestimate the boundaries of their own power. Yes, Daniel's authority as a VP covers engineering priorities. It covers resource allocation, program timelines, budget overruns, operational risks.
Right, typical VP stuff.
He can absolutely defer a software bug, but his authority absolutely does not cover federal export controls.
Oh, I see.
Those controls are set by federal regulation, specifically the Export Administration regulations. Inside any company, the authority to navigate or grant exceptions to those regulations is held exclusively by the empowered official or the export compliance function.
So all of his executive power, his title, his ability to manage the budget, it all effectively stops at the edge of this specific legal requirement.
It hits a brick wall. A VP can reprioritize the engineering work, but a VP cannot unilaterally defer an export sign-off or authorize the release of controlled technology. He has absolutely no legal standing to do so. And this is where standard risk acceptance frameworks in business actually trick leaders into a trap. Leaders are so culturally conditioned to say, I own the risk, let's move fast and break things.
Move fast and break things, yeah. The classic Silicon Valley mantra.
Right. They start treating federal compliance like just another slow vendor delivery or a late software patch. Daniel genuinely thought he was being an agile, decisive leader stepping up to protect his team's timeline.
But he wasn't.
No, instead, he was unilaterally authorizing a federal violation. He treated a hard, unmovable legal gate as a flexible, deferrable milestone.
That is a terrifying blind spot for any executive to have. Because, of course, a 4.51 p.m. email from a vice president does not just sit in a vacuum.
Definitely not.
It sets off a chain reaction. The pressure cascades immediately downward through the org chart.
Down to the people doing the actual work.
Exactly. So Sarah Lindfist is the senior engineer who technically owns the shared Helios library. She's the one sitting at the computer who actually has to click the button to grant access to the team.
Right.
She reads Daniel's email, and suddenly she is holding a massive dilemma regarding her teammate, Arjun.
This is the critical moment where the abstract, dry concept of export controls collides directly with human relationships and workplace culture.
Yeah, let's put you, the listener, right in Sarah's shoes. Arjun desperately needs the controlled subsystem package to finish his part of the design review by Friday.
The clock is ticking.
If he fails, the team fails. He is a brilliant engineer. He's been on this exact team for 2 years, and he literally sits three desks away from Sarah in the same office.
They're right there together.
They're trusted colleagues. But, and this is the core of the issue, Arjun is a foreign national working on an H-1B visa, and his country of nationality happens to be one whose classification is restricted without a specific government license.
Which means, legally, giving him access to that technical file requires an explicit export license from the government. Full stop. His physical location does not change his legal status regarding that technology.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Sarah is not entirely clueless. She actually half remembers the term deemed export from her mandatory annual compliance training.
Okay, so she has some awareness.
Right. But, like so many people, she assumes an export means physically packing up boxes of technical schematics and shipping them on a cargo plane overseas.
A very common misconception.
She looks over at Arjun, sitting three desks away, drinking coffee in the same U.S. office, and she rationalizes the situation. She thinks, you know, we're in the same building. No border is being crossed here. Nothing is leaving the country. This is just internal collaboration on a shared drive.
Yeah, that specific no border crossed rationalization is arguably the single most common and frankly the most dangerous misconception in all of corporate export compliance.
Really?
The most dangerous.
Oh, absolutely. The federal export code actually defines the export not by where a file travels geographically, but by the nationality of the eyes looking at it.
Oh. Under the deemed export rule, releasing controlled technology to a foreign national inside the United States is legally deemed to be an export directly to that person's home country.
So the location doesn't matter at all?
Not at all. The logic behind the law is that the technical knowledge has been transferred. A human brain absorbed the technology, so the international border was effectively crossed right there in the office cubicle.
That is wild. But even knowing that, let's look at the immense psychological weight bearing down on Sarah.
It's heavy.
She might vaguely remember her training, but she is staring at a written directive from the vice president of her division, explicitly instructing her to grant access immediately. I have to imagine she feels somewhat protected by that.
Oh, for sure.
Doesn't that email act as a shield for her? If she is just following direct orders from the top, doesn't that protect her from the compliance fallout?
It creates a powerful illusion of cover, but legally, it does the exact opposite.
Right.
Yeah, this is a very hard lesson for employees to internalize when their bosses are pressuring them. The VP's email does not magically transfer export authority down to Sarah. It doesn't make the act legal.
Oh, I see.
What it actually does is create a permanent, time-stamped, documented record that the entire team, Sarah included, was explicitly aware that the files lacked the required export sign-offs, and they consciously proceeded to break the rules anyway.
Oh, man.
It shifts the situation from an accidental oversight to a documented, intentional bypass of protocol. Instead of a shield, that email is essentially a signed confession.
A signed confession sitting right there in her inbox.
Mm.
That is brutal, but you really have to empathize with Sarah in this moment.
Yeah.
The Excella scenario breaks down the psychology here brilliantly. There are four specific, overlapping pressures that completely short-circuit her compliance training. It explains exactly why good people make these calls.
Yeah, the anatomy of the pressure in this case study is textbook. First, you have the raw weight of authority.
Right.
The VP put the order in writing. Human nature dictates that her brain says, I'm just following authorized direction from leadership. It's on him.
It's out of my hands.
Exactly. Second, you have the deadline. The Helios milestone is the most important financial event happening in the company. And if Arjun cannot do his work, the whole project stalls out and people might lose their jobs.
The third pressure is the one that really strikes me, though. Proximity and relationship.
It is the hardest one to overcome. Arjun is not a faceless foreign adversary trying to steal corporate secrets. He is her teammate.
Right.
He is the guy she brainstorms with every day. It feels deeply unnatural, even insulting, to look at a trusted colleague sitting three desks away and treat them like a restricted international destination.
Like you're alienating them.
Yeah, it violates the social contract of being a good teammate. And that emotional friction leads directly into the fourth pressure, the no border rationalization. Because it feels so unnatural, her brain searches for a reason to make it okay, landing on the logic of, well, we're in the same room, so it doesn't count as an export.
Knowing she is caught in that psychological vice grip, you can easily see how Sarah might try to invent her own middle ground, like a compromise.
People try that all the time.
What if she decides to play it safe by filtering the folder? You know, what if she only shares the specific parts of the file that she personally guesses are not highly controlled, keeping the most sensitive schematics hidden?
Oh, boy.
To an engineer trying to be a team player, that feels like a smart, balanced move. Keep Arjun working, hit the deadline, but protect the deepest secrets.
That instinct to compromise is a massive trap.
Why is that?
Because Sarah is a highly skilled engineer, but she is not an export compliance officer. She is completely unqualified to make legally binding classification calls on federal technology restrictions.
Oh.
If she starts guessing what is and isn't controlled, she is taking all of that federal liability directly onto her own shoulders. The training she received was designed for one specific outcome. The only correct behavior in her position was to recognize the trigger.
And what's the trigger?
The trigger is simple. Controlled technology combined with a foreign national. Once she recognizes that trigger, her only job is to stop, hold the access, and route the request straight to the compliance team.
So recognition and routing.
Recognition and routing. Engineers are not expected to solve the compliance problem just to flag it.
But the reality of the pressure cooker wins out. Sarah does not route it to compliance.
Mm-hmm.
She caves to the VP's timeline and grants Arjun access to the full technical library that very same Tuesday night.
Yep.
Sarah clicks the button, and in that fraction of a second, the violation is locked in.
Done deal.
Which brings us to the aftermath. We're going to jump 90 days into the future. Project Helios has had its design review, the dust has settled, the executives are happy, and a routine access audit is being conducted by Maya Okonkwo.
Right.
Maya is the company's empowered official for export compliance. And during this audit, she discovers the absolute disaster that Daniel and Sarah left behind.
And the nature of this disaster is spectacular because of how digital exports function.
Yes, the federal code is brutal here. Under 15 CFR, Section 734, Bonson 3, The deemed export to Arjun's restricted country of nationality happened the literal microsecond he opened that digital file on the shared drive.
Yep.
There was no physical shipping manifest for Maya to intercept at a loading dock. There was no customs agent checking a box at a border. The bell was rung digitally, instantly, and silently.
And it gets worse.
It does. To make the exposure even worse, the audit shows that because Daniel set his reckless directive to the entire team, two other foreign national contractors were also granted access.
Oh, no.
Plus, there was a recorded Zoom call where the team walked through the controlled technical details with everyone present.
The genie is entirely out of the bottle.
Yeah.
And you cannot unring that bell. The export has definitively occurred.
So, as someone looking at this from a pure problem-solving perspective, my immediate reaction is containment. Okay, Maya caught the breach. It is a terrible situation. But why can't she just immediately go into the IT system, revoke Arjun's access, and pull him off the Helios project today to stop the bleeding? Just lock down the data immediately.
This raises an important question, and it is where the situation shifts from a simple, isolated compliance failure into a massive, multi-departmental legal headache.
Okay.
Maya is now walking an incredibly precarious legal tightrope. It is a double bind that companies fall into all the time when they try to fix these issues, quietly or reactively. On one side of the tightrope, you have export law.
Right.
The regulations clearly state that you cannot allow an unauthorized foreign national to continue accessing controlled technology. The law demands immediate restriction.
Right, so that seems to point directly to yanking his access right now.
Yeah.
But what is waiting on the other side of that tightrope?
On the other side, you have United States anti-discrimination law, overseen by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC. Yeah. Federal employment law strictly forbids penalizing, restricting, or demoting an employee based solely on their citizenship, nationality, or national origin.
Wait, so if Maya executes a snap nationality-based removal of Arjun to satisfy the export rules,
yep.
She's actually creating a massive human resources nightmare.
She is stepping right into an employment discrimination trap. Mm. If she suddenly cuts Arjun's access explicitly because he is from a specific country, while letting the U.S.-born engineers sitting right next to him keep their access, she trades a federal export violation for a federal employment discrimination violation.
That is insane.
She solves her problem with the Bureau of Industry and Security by handing the company a massive lawsuit from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
That is an impossible position for a compliance officer to be in. The friction between those two sets of laws is intense. How do you possibly navigate a double bind like that without breaking one law to satisfy another?
The only way out of the double bind is to ensure that your resolution strategy is anchored to the technology itself, not the individual person.
Okay, explain that.
Any access decision has to be based on the objective classification of the technology and the resulting license requirements, and that standard must be applied equally to everyone in the company.
So it's about the data tiers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You cannot restrict Arjun because of his passport. You have to apply a consistent company-wide rule stating that anyone lacking the required export license for this specific data tier cannot have access, regardless of who they are or where they were born.
But auditing the tech, setting up those objective tiers, and applying them company-wide takes a significant amount of time to assess and implement properly. You can't do that in an afternoon.
Exactly. Which is why Maya's only viable strategy is not a quick IT fix. She has to immediately convene human resources, the general counsel, and senior leadership in a room.
They all have to be involved.
They have to scope the entire exposure together. And crucially, they have to prepare for a voluntary self-disclosure, commonly called a VSD, to the Bureau of Industry and Security.
Let's define that for the listener. A voluntary self-disclosure means the company has to proactively go to the government, hand over the audit, and say, "We messed up. Here exactly how we broke the law, and here is our comprehensive plan to fix it."
Yeah.
You are essentially turning yourself in.
Yes. And while it is painful, the VSD is the single biggest mitigation lever the company has to reduce the inevitable fines and penalties.
Because you're being honest.
Exactly. If Maya tries to remediate this quietly, if she just tightens the IT access settings and sweeps the Tuesday night incident under the rug, she forfeits that mitigation entirely.
Wow.
If the government finds out later, say through a disgruntled whistleblower, a routine audit, or a totally separate investigation, the penalties will be exponentially worse because the company chose to hide the violation.
It's the cover-up that gets you.
Always.
Yeah.
Daniel's desire to grant access now, figure it out later, has ultimately forced the entire company into a highly structured, very expensive legal confession.
So what does this all mean? If we step back and look at the whole journey of this deep dive, we have watched a catastrophic, slow-motion train wreck caused entirely by people trying to do their jobs well.
Yeah, that's the sad truth.
We saw a vice president profoundly misunderstand the limits of his own authority, making a category error by treating a hard federal law as a flexible program bottleneck.
Right.
That misunderstanding created a massive pressure cooker of executive authority and slipping deadlines. And that pressure forced a senior engineer to ignore her compliance training, leaning heavily on proximity bias and the no border myth to rationalize breaking the rules for a teammate.
A perfect storm.
Truly. And all of that agility, all of that whatever it takes momentum, resulted in an instantaneous, unrecallable federal violation that trapped the compliance team in a brutal legal double bind between export laws and anti-discrimination laws.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the lesson for anyone listening who sits in a leadership role or anyone handling sensitive data is profound.
What's the takeaway?
In high-stakes environments, grant access now, figure it out later is not a strategy for agility. It is literally a confession of negligence.
Ouch.
True leadership in these spaces does not mean aggressively bulldozing through every roadblock you encounter. It means having the maturity and the operational discipline to treat compliance sign-offs as fixed, unmovable gates. You simply cannot defer them.
Even if it hurts the timeline.
Yes. Holding that line might mean having an incredibly uncomfortable conversation with a client, a sponsor, or your own board of directors about a delayed timeline. But taking the heat for a delayed milestone is exactly what leadership requires.
Yeah.
It is infinitely better and drastically cheaper than taking the heat from federal regulators because your clever workaround triggered a national security violation.
It really does fundamentally redefine what it means to be an effective problem solver in a modern corporate environment. Sometimes the best way to solve a problem is to refuse to bypass the safety mechanism.
Well said.
And that leaves us with a final thought. I really want you to mull over as we wrap up today's deep dive. Think about the everyday digital tools you use right now to do your job. The shared cloud folders, the automated email distribution lists, the instantly recorded Zoom calls, the Slack channels.
We live on those tools.
We do. We have built an entire global corporate culture around the idea of frictionless instant sharing. The goal is always to remove barriers and maximize operational speed. But if a federal export violation can happen the exact millisecond a file is clicked by a colleague sitting three desks away,
yeah,
are the very tools we use to work faster actually turning our own offices into a minefield of invisible instantaneous borders?
That is a great question.
Next time you're rushing to hit a tight deadline and your mouse hovers over that share all button to save a little time, ask yourself, who exactly are you sharing it with? And do you actually have the legal authority to make that click? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning those standard procedures in your own workplace, and we will see you next time.